The next program is a political speech by Earl Browder under the auspices of the National Election Campaign Committee, Communist Party. It is broadcast under the requirements of a federal law, Section 315 of the Communications Act of 1934, which in effect provides that the broadcasters must afford equal broadcasting opportunities to all legally qualified candidates for public office. The views expressed by the speaker are his own.
This is the first in a series of nationwide broadcasts by the communist candidates for President and Vice President of the United States. The speaker tonight is Earl Browder, General Secretary of the Communist Party and its candidate for president. It is my privilege to present a great American and a courageous champion of peace, jobs, and security for the people of America, the communist candidate for President of the United States, Earl Browder.
Friends and fellow Americans, we are witnessing a presidential election campaign, which is indeed a peculiar one. The issues and problems facing our country are fateful, of far-reaching importance, beyond anything in our national experience since the days of Abraham Lincoln. Yet the two major candidates and their parties are systematically blotting out every major difference between them on the most central issues. All possibility of choosing the future course of the United States by casting ballots to one side or the other between Democratic and Republican parties has been cut off from the voters because both Mr. Roosevelt and Mr. Wilkie stand for essentially the same policies. A man from Mars visiting us now might jump to the conclusion that this fact is evidence of a peculiar unanimity of opinion, sentiment, and interest among the 46 million American voters. But certainly no intelligent American could make such a mistake. Not only is the divergence among the voters deeper and sharper than in many generations, but also, and more important, the decisive majority is opposed to the course toward militarization and war upon which Roosevelt and Wilkie are united. But in order to find electoral expression for that majority opinion, the voters have no alternative but to break their traditional political allegiances and turn to one of the minority parties, among which only the Communist Party offers a genuine alternative. There is no unity of the people in support of the united policy of Wilkie Roosevelt. But there is a newfound unity among our aristocracy of wealth and social position, the economic royalists, whose hatred was welcomed by the Roosevelt of 1936, are the very men who chose from their own top ranks the candidacy of Wilkie, not to fight, but to support the Roosevelt of 1940. Things have gone so far that one of the more candid and simple-minded Republican agitators, David Lawrence, uttered a cry of alarm the other day and hysterically asked, "Why are businessmen so reticent in this campaign? Can anybody recall in recent weeks a single speech of importance by any outstanding industrialist or manager of any large enterprise urging the public to support Wendell Wilkie? Of what are businessmen afraid?" End of quotation. Mr. Lawrence has, of course, missed the point of the whole affair. The businessmen are no longer afraid of Mr. Roosevelt, and that is the nub of the election campaign as it stands today. Mr. Lawrence is still living in the atmosphere of a dead and gone era in which Roosevelt was threatening to master the economic royalists. Roosevelt long ago abandoned that fleeting ambition. He is now leading the battle of America to master instead the labor movement and the majority of the American people. He is busily proving to the economic royalists that he is indeed indispensable for them and their imperialist ambitions. So the businessmen are not afraid of him. They are quite content to let the campaign run its course, knowing that whatever the outcome, they have their man. It is the old game of heads I win, tails you lose. Tweedledum and Tweedledee were never so much alike as in 1940. But the economic royalists are afraid of the people. Even with the presidential election sewed up, they are afraid of the people. Even when Roosevelt can openly step outside the Constitution on behalf of their class policy and assume dictatorial powers in foreign policy, they remain afraid of the people. Even when conscription can be forced upon an unwilling people for undefined imperialist aims, they are still afraid of the people. And that is why they even hesitate to speak up for the barefoot boy of Wall Street who comes right out of their own family circles. They may well be afraid. This is 1940, not 1914 or 1917. 2.5 decades of experience with imperialist war and an imperialist peace of violence have taught the people much, and especially the working class. The people are developing a genius for undermining and defeating the best laid plans of the upper classes, the real enemies of the people. The masses of the people may move slowly, but even when they only slightly stir, the economic royalists have learned to tremble. Consider for a moment that un-American and unprecedented measure, the conscription law, that has been forced upon the country by the Wilkie Roosevelt coalition and the mobilized money power of the land. That was a heavy blow against the people and a signal victory for Wall Street. Wherever our ruling circles gather about the festive board and spill champagne in celebration of this victory, there is a grinning skeleton at the feast to spoil their pleasure. They are haunted by the memory of a great labor movement of 8 to 9 million members, so consciously and unitedly against conscription that even the most trusted and reliable political agents of the Roosevelt-Wilkie coalition, the men they draw into their kitchen cabinets and defense boards to represent labor, did not dare raise their voices in support of that measure, much as they desired, much as they were pressed to do so. They are haunted by the fact that in a Congress these gentlemen own body, soul, and breeches, in which they have been registering for their policies with all votes against one. On this conscription bill, when the people began to stir only a little, 2/3 of the Republican congressmen voted against the measure, which their presidential candidate had endorsed. And its only solid support came from the solid South, where 3/4 of the people are disfranchised. The significance of the vote against conscription in Congress is not diminished by the fact that the Republicans are equally reactionary with the Democrats, that they indulge themselves the luxury of this vote because they were assured of the bill passing anyway by Democratic votes, that they were guilty of the grossest opportunism and cynicism, that they were acting merely as the outs giving a blow against the ins. All that is on the whole true, but it merely emphasizes another truth, that the congressmen knew the people back home were so fiercely and consciously against conscription that it was good politics, as the phrase goes, to go along with that sentiment. Yes, the fat boys have reason for sober second thought. In the imperialistic adventures they plan for America, the people will not remain for long mere passive pawns to be shoved around the chessboard of war. Yes, in spite of the most gigantic conspiracy in American history to disfranchise the American people, to deprive them of a vote in the most fateful decisions our country has faced in many generations, the people find a way to make their voices heard and their influence felt. That is why the economic royalists, the reactionaries who are hurrying America into a disastrous war, are afraid of the 1940 elections, despite the fact that they have the two major parties hogtied and delivered before the event. That is why they are afraid of the Communist Party. Who knows, with the major candidates and parties united against a powerful swell of mass opinion and sentiment, that great numbers might not render their protest by voting communist in November. That is why the Roosevelt-Wilkie United Front forces are proceeding systematically to deprive the communists of their political and electoral rights in this campaign. That is why they sent the West Virginia farmer, Oscar Wheeler, to prison for 15 years for the crime of soliciting signatures to a communist election petition on the grounds of false pretenses, although the petition was in pure legal form and no signer could have had the slightest doubt what he was signing. That is why scores of workers are under indictment in Pennsylvania on similar charges. That is why in Illinois, the Kelly Horner Roosevelt Democrats, on orders from Washington, staged mob violence against communist election workers and are holding dozens in jail on trumped-up charges of sedition. That is why in several states, high officials have openly defied the election laws to arbitrarily rule the Communist Party off the ballot. That is why in New York, they are openly talking about finding some subterfuge to deny the communists the right to have our ticket on the ballot as we have had in every election since 1920. The Roosevelt machine has an additional incentive to suppress the Communist Party. In Pennsylvania, Illinois, Ohio, and especially in New York, all pivotal states, it is agreed that the vote may be so close that the communists, even without any great increase in strength, might be the balance of power. The Roosevelt machine, thinking that the communists cannot possibly vote for Wall Street's Wilkie, hoped to steal our votes on behalf of Roosevelt by denying the opportunity to vote for our own candidate. In the past, the Roosevelt forces sometimes had our voluntary support, and in 1938, they held New York State against Dewey and the Republicans only with our help, by less than the margin of votes we threw to them. Now that they cannot get our voluntary support, they hope to obtain it by trickery and violation of free electoral rights. Wendell Willkie himself admitted in an article in the New Republic that the Roosevelt administration's actions against the communists, and specifically against myself, had this immoral and partisan motive. But that was before he became the Republican candidate, and even before his secret pact with Roosevelt. Now he will not break his silence on this issue, even to keep an important block of votes from being stolen for his rival Roosevelt. The truth is mighty. It is terribly embarrassing, even to the most powerful political personages and combinations. Though it be spoken only by the weakest of voices against which newspapers and radio have been conducting an unexampled campaign of slander and prejudice, that is why I cannot promise you that I will continue to speak to you throughout the campaign, the powers that be consider it more convenient to have me behind bars for the next several years. That is why I cannot promise you that you will have everywhere the opportunity to vote for the communist ticket in November. For in many places, our party workers are being beaten up, thrown in jail, or both, our election petitions thrown out, their signers blacklisted and driven from their jobs. That is also why candidate Roosevelt made a beautiful speech at Philadelphia the other day, extolling the virtues of free elections. That is why, on the other hand, we firmly expect that among the millions of Americans who truly believe in democracy, who truly believe in free elections, who truly hate conscription and war, who truly oppose our country being dragged into the bloody world scramble for empire with its profits for the few and starvation and death for the many, that among these millions who are America, a great number, greater than anyone now suspects, will vote communist as the only way to vote in any degree as their own conscience dictates.
The program just concluded was a political speech under the auspices of the National Election Campaign Committee, Communist Party. It was broadcast under the requirements of a federal law, Section 315 of the Communications Act of 1934, which in effect provides that the broadcasters must afford equal broadcasting opportunities to all legally qualified candidates for public office. The views expressed by the speaker were his own. The broadcast emanated from the Manhattan Opera House, New York City. This is the National Broadcasting Company.